Report coming to you live from our radio and television studios here in Northwest Pennsylvania. You know, it's great to have people like Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari. It's great to have patriots like that, men who care about the future of the world and are doing something about it. He's just an amazing man, giving you a view from the ground in terms of what's going on in Iraq, Syria, the Middle East, and letting you know the real. I mean, you talk about the real news, not the fake news. This is the real news, and he's the purveyor of it. And he's been on the show before, and to much fanfare as well. Before we get to our guest, I want to mention that you know, time is running out. It's December 1st already, so when you're looking for perhaps Christmas gifts, think of survival gifts. And when you think of survival gifts, think of Minuteman Stove. Minuteman Stove, they're having a special between now and Christmas. Here's the deal. You place an order for a stove from Minuteman Stove. Well, you know what? In my apologies, if you missed the Cyber Monday sale, that was over last week. Regardless, at any price, I would recommend a Minuteman Stove. Minuteman Stove right now, they're offering a special for Hagman and Hagman listeners. Let me just get on this proper script here. Go to MinutemanStove.com, MinutemanStove.com. Order a stove for Minuteman Stove. By the way, folks, if you haven't seen these Minuteman Stoves, it's a rocket stove that really it uses 1/10 of the necessary requirement of wood that an open fire would. Small amount of sticks, twigs for fuel. You'll always be able to find enough fuel for the Minuteman, even if you live in a city. The Minuteman Stove, fully insulated with ceramic refractory insulation. It focuses the heat where it's supposed to be, results in cooking power comparable to that of a kitchen stove. It can also be used on a picnic table because of the outside, the temperature. It reaches only about 200 degrees. It's you can pick it up essentially with your hands. The Minuteman will also, it creates no smoke, which I just find amazing. When I use the Minuteman Stove, no smoke whatsoever. So if you've got people around that are sensitive to smoke, or if you don't want to give away your location, this is the smoke. And that speaks to the efficiency as well of this Minuteman Rocket Stove. It's self-contained, seals airtight. It's got a wonderful seal around the edge, around the top edge. It's got a carrying handle. It weighs 14 pounds, travels clean, no smells or soot. These are just some of the features. Minuteman Stoves are made in America, folks. They're also serving with our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're handmade, battle-proven, extremely rugged. Minuteman Stoves come with a 2-year no-hassle guarantee. And by the way, nobody to date has ever attempted to cash in on the guarantee. That's how good they are. MinutemanStove.com, MinutemanStove.com, MinutemanStove.com. Joe, I'm going to toss it back to you, sir.
Yeah, for the remainder of the show, we are going to be joined. We are joined by Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, and he is with us to talk about the view from Iraq and Syria, what is happening in the Middle East. He is the head of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, and also Dr. Frederick Krantz will be joining us at 8:30 with Lieutenant Colonel Mr. Sangari. It's great to have you on the show, Lieutenant.
It's good to be back again.
It's great to have you back. So much has happened. You were on in August 22nd, I believe, of this year, and you've been done several interviews with a number of outlets, folks, and you can, in our description of the YouTube episode, and Lieutenant Colonel Sangari's website's there, and you can do a search and find many of the interviews. They're all fantastic interviews that you've done. You've given a very comprehensive overview of what's happening in the Middle East, and specifically with Iraq and Syria and ISIS. Can you give us a general update since the last time you've been on about what has been happening as we see the U.S. and Russia and Turkey getting involved, and you know, we hear news about different areas and regions, you know, pushback in Mosul and Aleppo, and it seems like there continues to be struggles in these cities between the.
Are we winning? I guess.
Yeah, and the forces fighting terrorism.
Well, I don't know if we can qualify it as a, if we're winning. It's the same as is. The current administration is still in charge. I don't know how much is going to change, even with a new administration coming in. As you gentlemen were speaking earlier, in the first hour, the systems that the U.S. uses are still there. The individuals who are within those systems, if they're not political appointees who might be replaced, might be foreign service officers who have worked over a number of administrations. So if you take a look at what we've done within the region going back to 2003, and this was something recently that the Syrian Army commander relayed specifically to the embassy of the United States, or I should say the council in Erbil. And the reality is this, that we've had multiple different Department of State representatives show up. We've had multiple different cabinet appointments under different presidents show up. We've had multiple different Department of Defense folks show up. We've had the U.S. military with a strong presence out of Iraq, back again into Iraq. And really nothing has changed. And for the folks on the ground, one thing that they look forward to with the current election of President-elect Trump is that it was a movement at the local levels by Americans specifically, that Americans say, you know what, we want to make a complete change to the system. And what we want to do is we want to bring somebody in who's an outsider, who's really not a politician, who doesn't have that background in defense procedures, and we want to make him the president of the United States and make him the commander-in-chief of our military forces. From the Middle East perspective, especially with the certain Christians in Iraq, the message that was relayed to the embassy was, if it's good enough for United States, for Americans, to realize that a change needs to be done, we expect to see the same thing here, because it's not working. You're not winning in the region. You haven't won since 2003. You haven't won in Syria. You haven't won in Iraq. You haven't won in Turkey. You haven't won in the Iranian affairs issues. You're not winning in Yemen. You haven't won with Saudi. You haven't won in Libya. So across the board, it's just absolute failure. You've lost people, resources, personnel, equipment, and reputation. For a change to take place, when a new administration comes in, the individuals who have been advising multiple different presidents within the United States government have to literally be either replaced or have to be put on the spot some of the toughest questions that a president can ask them. As an example, to give you an update of what's happening within the region, I was down there recently. I went there for the Mosul clearing operations, which started sometime after October 7th. We stayed there and came back. I came back on the 27th, realizing that the Mosul fight was going to take longer than we predicted, given the fact that the KRG, Kurdish Regional Government Forces under the Peshmerga, and also the Iraqi multi-forces, which are mostly Shia controlled, with maybe 1,500 Sunnis fighting within those ranks under the Hashish Shabi, which is one of the Iranian-aligned militias that now has been recognized to become the next state apparatus when it comes to anti-terrorism, literally the creation of another Mukhabarat intelligence system for the current Abadi regime. And these individuals were just not capable, and if they were going into an area, as they did in Fallujah, Fallujah wasn't liberated, and there were massacres that took place of the citizens of Fallujah when one group came in and killed the rest. For the Assyrian Christians, all the villages that we had in the Assyrian plain, they were completely destroyed. They were destroyed based on the fact that Assyrian Christians were not given the support to be able to take their own villages. So the support was given only to the Iraqi military and was given specifically to the Kurdish regional government, who literally knowing that that area might be something that they may not retain in the future, they destroyed everything. They just went in and destroyed all the towns. There's no infrastructure left for the Christian Assyrians. One of the villages, or, you know, a little bit larger cities in our area sector for the Syrian army, was 85% destroyed, to include the cemeteries. The churches were destroyed. major cities within Bartella, which were Assyrian villages, Assyrian cities, when the church leadership went into those churches after the so-called liberalization of the cities to try to conduct mass just to bless the city church, where they were actually conducting killing of individuals, tortures. They were kicked out by the Iraqi Special Forces commanders because you had Christian Assyrians actually had the audacity to try to conduct a church service in their own city's church.
Aren't we backing the Iraqi Special Forces of America?
Yes, we are. We're backing them. We are funding them. But we are not funding the specific Assyrian groups who have asked to conduct joint operations for the taking of their own towns and villages. I'll give you an example. Bartella, which is very strategic in the Suriname Plain, was never a Shabak city, meaning Shabak being Shia of Iraq, a group of Shia of Iraq. Well, 2,000 Shabak have been sent by the Iraqi government of Iraq, under the guise that they are part of the federal police divisions to operate it out of Bartella. We've taken the mayor of Mosul, which was a Shabak, and we've moved them to Bartella in order for them to have a headquarters while the Mosul operations are taking place. While this is being done, all the Shabak are now registering to be residents of Bartella. So what are you doing here? You basically are coming in now and you're liberating these cities and you're changing the demographics of who's supposed to live there. So you're literally, any city that has an infrastructure, you're now turning it over to the Shia of Iraq. Before it was the Kurdish, Sunni Muslim Kurds who controlled them. Now you're basically flipping those cities to the Shia of Iraq. This is a problem that the Syrian Christians and all of the Christians in their historical homeland have to deal with.
Social engineering by war. I mean, Wow. Okay.
85% of the infrastructure of one city destroyed, guys. 75% of most of the towns have been burned down in the Syria Nima Plain. These are all Christian villages. If you look, the Shabak villages are in the Syrian Nima Plain, which the Iraqi army liberated. Their infrastructure is intact. The ones that the Kurdish regional government came in and liberated, their infrastructure is intact if they were non-Christian villages. But if there are certain Christian villages, pretty much destroyed. If you take across the board, 45% of everything that we saw when I was on the ground was either burned out or destroyed, no infrastructure. That means the Christians do not even have a place to go back to. This is a systematic process by which the root of Christianity is being eradicated in the Middle East, whether by ISIS or supposedly our allies who are more interested in moving their peace in order to ensure that the Christians do not have a footprint. Now, if you want to ask about the news makers, I don't know why there's not reporters down there sticking a microphone in the face of leadership in government of Iraq or the Kurdish regional government asking them, why is it that that Shabak village wasn't destroyed when you liberated it, but the Syrian Christian village was absolutely pummeled? Explain that to us.
Okay. I mean, obviously, it's by design, and it's a war against Christianity in the Middle East. That's I'm having a hard time, really. Wow. To hear this, Lieutenant Colonel, to hear this is just incredible. And folks, I hope you're hearing this. Go ahead, sir.
I mean, it's just simple. 40% complete destruction of all the cities and infrastructure. 75% all of them burned out inside and out. The major cities of Baghdadi, Karkush, commercially, Bartella, Bashika, Telescope, Telkep, and just so everybody knows, and Telkep, one of the cities specifically located there, is not even cleared yet. So they've even started claiming Mosul, they haven't cleared some of those cities are very significant to the Christian Assyrians. And when you're talking about villages like Batmai, to include the cemeteries being destroyed, if you drive up and down your local highways here, our cemeteries in the United States are in better shape than the Assyrian Christian villages are in Iraq. And a lot of those IDPs would pay dollars to live in our cemeteries, where they cannot even live in their own villages. Mm-hmm. And this is under United States watch. So the Trump administration comes in, what are they going to do?
Okay, precisely. I mean, there's got to be a level of knowledge among the Obama regime, as I call it, not even an administration. They've got to understand what they're doing. This can't be by incompetence or through incompetence. This has got to be by design. There's no other way to explain this, or am I wrong?
Well, I was. If you go to state.gov, they have the State Department releases a monthly newsletter, and the most current newsletter you'll see is called. If you go to pages page 1 of 31, specifically, is called A Helping Hand. It is written by John Underland, senior coordinator for the Refugees and IDP Affairs in Baghdad, Iraq, Embassy of Baghdad. And here are some of the notes that he has put in here, specifically. And then he has written that Iraqi IDP crisis arose from the efforts to push Daesh, also called ISIL, out of Iraq and the Levant, okay, and out of Mosul specifically, which is the second largest city. And he talks about how we have this conflict and previous conflict had created 240 million refugees, specifically from Syria and throughout the entire region. You go farther down into his notes, he talks about that only 14% of Iraqi IDPs reside in camps established by the UN. So the Iraqi Red Crescent Society or donor nations such as the United Arab Emirates, the rest live in estimated 3,800 locally spread throughout the country. And I've seen these individuals, some of them basically run trinket shops on the sidewalks in Erbil, which is the capital of the Kurdish regional government right now. And in empty parking lots, empty buildings, mosques and churches. This is written on the Department of State site. Okay. Now, if you go farther down, he talks about that the United States is the largest contributor of humanitarian assistance to these vulnerable Iraqis, providing $1 billion since October of 2014 to include $181 million in additional life-saving assistance that Deputy Secretary Anthony Blinken announced during his September visit to Iraq. Where is this money? Where is the news media makers doing a FOIA request to ask, where is this money going to? I didn't see it to any of the Assyrian Christians on the ground. There's no money being provided, no military support being provided. Their towns are absolutely destroyed. They're being replaced by other ethnicities. And the House resolution that we talked about last time I was on your program, they even took the name Assyrian and dumped it to the side because they wanted it to be nothing more than a recognition as a Christian minority rather than an ethnicity. And they considered in the same resolution that there were genocide against the Shebek, who are currently now moving and taking territory that literally used to be Assyrian homes and towns. In Shadat itself, you had one house that was a Shebek house before the clearing before the ISIS attacked. Now you have 80 houses there. And all that is being supported by the government of Iraq. Now, the Assyrians are fighting to be part of a federalized Iraq. But for us to fight to be part of federalized Iraq, that means we need to have rights. The United States government, when they sent me downrange, and I went to fight there for over 4 years in a row, my main concentration was to bring democracy to the region. And to me, democracy by definition means that everybody has a right, has a voice. Where is this democracy? Why are we not supporting it or forcing it? Why are we not funding individuals at the lowest level who all they've asked for is to have a say and a voice in their future. I was in displaced camps. 7-year-old girls whose teeth are really falling out. You have women, Christian women, who have really reduce themselves to an extent in certain areas of prostitution to survive. You have young kids who haven't had schooling for 3-4 years now. You know, we talk about no child left behind here, but we don't care about if they're left behind. Not only is the current generation of Christian Assyrians or of Christianity being eradicated, they have killed the future generation too, because they're literally nothing more than people living in their coffins. They have no future. They're done. And now you didn't even give them a place to go back to because you destroyed all their infrastructure to say that you're clearing Mosul. And you force the Christian Assyrians to have to go get money from individuals who are being looked at in the world court as possibly conducting war crimes. Why? Because the Department of State says for foreign multi-sales is how it works. How come it doesn't work that way in Syria? How come you find other ways to get the money to individuals that you call your allies? But you can't get the money to Christian Assyrians who have a joint force capability of 6,000. How come you didn't bother to support the Yazidis when they needed support? Who said, we will unite with the Assyrians, create a 10,000-man force. Possibly, if you push it to the Mosul, send you a 20,000-man force. Why? Because it was not to your benefit? So what is to the benefit of the United States? To have a black mark on his resume that it eradicated the roots of Christianity in the region? And what are we going to get out of it? More dead soldiers, like the young man that we recently lost in Syria, our Navy SEAL? What was his sacrifice worth? What did we accomplish from that one soldier dying on the battlefield in Syria? I don't know what the decisions going to be made by the new president, and I really don't know who's advising him. But if it's the same people who are advising him that have advised us into this, I wouldn't call it quagmire, into this level of stupidity, if I can use a personal comment, then I would say that he is going to be in a worse situation than President Obama probably was during his administration.
This is incredible. Wow. Okay. So what you're saying is what we're witnessing today is the genocide. Is genocide even the right word?
Cultural genocide of Christianity.
Well, yeah. I mean, the eradication of Christianity across the Middle East. And it's by design. And you are one of the few people out there, your organization, you're one of the few fighting for the Christians, whether they're the Assyrian, regardless, you're fighting for the Christians. But the fight, I mean, you're up against the most powerful, military machinery, really, of the world. And I just can't imagine what you're seeing, place.
And from what you're seeing and what you're reporting to what, you know, we get from news reports and news outlets as information coming from the Middle East, it's almost, you know, two different things. And for years we've heard of how, you know, the U.S. is supporting, you know, the citizens that are going to fight, you know, the terrorist ISIS in these different regions. But we continue to see, you know, the spread of ISIS and this terrorism, and they continue to take over these cities. And I guess the real problem is, you know, the United States average American is not concerning themselves with what's going on in the Middle East because it is not in their viewpoint. It's not affecting them. It's not affecting their bottom line. And, you know, it's out of sight, out of mind, I think, for a lot of people, which is truly sad. But, you know, you raise a lot of interesting points and questions. You know, where is all this money going? Who are we really funding? Where are our weapons?
Joe, and Lieutenant Colonel, if I can ask you just one more time, because I myself want to refer to this document. What document were you referring to with respect to the, which you were reading from, citing from? Because I think this needs to be, you know, exposed.
Yes, if you go, it's basically out of the State Magazine, so the Department of State released some magazine. And if you go to the December 2016 extracts, which are, you'll find it in a PDF format, it's called A Helping Hand. Okay. And it basically is three major pages out of that State Magazine that if you take a look at it. It really will bring up questions that you have to ask. Where is our money going to? What are we doing in the region? Look, guys, United States is not a government entity only. And I think this is where a lot of Americans, maybe you don't understand why guys like me still are supporting the Assyrian efforts, Christian efforts in the region. I think some people don't understand why, you know, we created the United Assyrian Appeal to raise money to support the multifamilies of the Christians are fighting downrange. It's not just territory geographically that we say this is what United States is, this is what America is. It's individuals in America. And this, in the long run, becomes a stain on individual Americans. I cut off talking to the government folks years ago. You know, I've been in the system. I know how the system works. I know that the people in the system really only care about their next promotion. Yeah, there's a lot of great Americans that are working, but a lot of them who are shedding blood and dying down range have no clue that, you know, you got some guy who made a decision what the policy for the Middle East needs to be 4 years ago, and they're still driving on that policy, even though that policy is actually doing damage to the United States.
Lieutenant Colonel, hold on, Lieutenant Colonel, we're up against a break.
We're coming up against a break right now. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Dr. Frederick Krantz for the next half hour with you, Lieutenant Colonel Sangari, of the head of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Talking with Lieutenant Sargis Sangari, and in a moment we're going to be joined by Dr. Frederick Krantz from actually a friend of Lieutenant Sangari, but
he's the director of the Canadian Institute of Jewish Research, founder and director of Liberal Arts College, Concordia University, Montreal, Canada. He has a doctorate in history from Cornell University. He's also the author. His latest book is History from Below, Development of Mass Politics and Popular Movements.
But you know what, folks? Everyone needs to be paying attention to what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on, the mass genocide of Christians. Look at what's taking place in Syria. Look at what has been taking place in Iran. Look at how, or Iraq, and look at how Iran figures into this picture as well. Look at all of the fighting forces in the Middle East. Isn't this what we're always talking about? In fact, everyone should be really interested and tuned into this program. I can't imagine right now any more important topic geopolitically than what we're talking about right now. And boy, I'll tell you, getting this information right, this is ground level information.
You're talking about fake news and things like that.
Yeah.
The what's coming out of the Middle East, there's so much fake news.
That's
and,
exactly
you see,
right.
Conflicting headlines. You know, today there's a headline from the Financial Times was up on Drudge, Syrian rebels and secret talks with Moscow to end Aleppo fighting. How many times have we seen, and maybe this is happening, but how many times have we seen, you know, reports that they're, you know, so close to ending the fighting, so close to recapturing a city?
Everything was started really with a destabilization process in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. Before we get back to our guests, folks, I just want to ask if you've heard about our new sponsor, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Have you heard about them? If you haven't, check them out. 20,000 plus products on their website. Over 20,000 products. And they're getting more added daily. They've got anything and everything you ever need for your survival, your camping needs, everyday needs. It's all on sale and competitively priced. That's MasterPreps.com. Folks, the holidays, Christmas right around the corner, and what a great place to get any last-minute shopping done, any shopping period done. Master Preps has all of your outdoor camping, prepping, survival needs covered, from tents to backpacks to hunting scopes to prepping supplies. MasterPreps.com has it all. They carry high-quality companies. They deal with all the high-quality, proven companies, so your order is never... I mean, none of this is dime store-level equipment. From water filters to tents to, I mean, you name it, they've got it. So if you need a few ideas for that hard person to shop for, go to masterpreps.com. Again, over 20,000 products and more being added daily. And we thank them for coming on board, masterpreps.com. Now, Joe, go ahead and take this, because this, folks, wow.
Yeah, we have a guest who's joining Lieutenant Colonel Sangari, a Professor Frederick Krantz, the director of the Canadian Institute of Jewish Research. Dr. Krantz, it's great to have you on the Hagman and Hagman Report.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you on, and I want to give, again, thanks to Bill McIntosh for setting this all up. And Bill and John done a fantastic job setting this program up.
And you two guys know each other, right, Lieutenant Colonel Sangari and Dr. Krantz?
Yes, we were just at a conference together in Toronto. Sargas, how are you?
Good, good. Thank you, Professor.
Good to hear your voice.
Guys, I think we should like back out and let you guys have the floor. Seriously, we don't want to get in the way. Lieutenant Colonel, we're going to turn it over to you. So, I mean, I'm kind of serious. We're going to turn it over to you because I think the people need to hear exactly what you guys have to say without us butting in. So, Lieutenant Colonel, go ahead and take it away.
Well, I think the lead was actually taken by Professor Krantz because CIJR established a conference recently, gave me the honor to be part of their panel, and we spoke about the genocide of the Christians in the Middle East and why is the world silent. And I think that it was eloquent what Professor Krantz said specifically as to what is happening in the region. I'm going to kind of turn it over to him and let him speak from his perspective as to why is the world silent on this topic. Professor, please go ahead and take the lead on this one. I think it's more important for him to understand your piece.
Yeah, the Canadian Institute for Jewish Research in Montreal is a conservative academic pro-Israel think tank, but we've become concerned increasingly in recent years with the persecution of Christians in the Middle East and the lack of Western, European or North American, U.S.-Canadian, response to it, awareness of it. It's quite striking that people are not aware that severe persecution of Christians is occurring across the Middle East and leading to the decline of the Christian population and the situation in Iraq, particularly in relation to Assyrian Christians in the around Mosul area, is a kind of genocide. We became aware of the Yazidi people who are not Christian, they're Zoroastrians, but we're not aware of the Christian persecution and genocide. So we have some statistics that the audience would be interested in. I'll just briefly run through them. In 1900, there were over 2 million Christians in the Middle East. Today, there are less than 300,000, and they're declining very quickly. In 1910, Christians were about 14% of the Middle Eastern population. Today, they are under 4%. People don't realize that it is the Christian populations who really are indigenous to the Middle East, and the Assyrian Christians of the Mosul area and the Nineveh Plain are the earliest Christians, post-biblical, the oldest Christian community in the Christian world. And the Arabs came very much later, Muslim Arabs. Islam came much later in the 7th century. So this millennial Christian population is under threat. It is threatened. And we see the problem, I think, clearly in the whole issue of the Syrian refugees, the people fleeing the terrible civil war in Syria and the Russian intervention and the Iranian intervention. Syrian Christians are 10% of the population of Syria, but when you look at the refugees who are coming into the U.S. and Canada, you discover they're a tiny, tiny percentage. In the U.S., something like 68 Christians were admitted recently, where according to population, there should have been at least 1,300. And one of the things that's really striking is that you discover that not only are the Christians not valorized, they're not supported by the West, which is, after all, part of what used to be called Christendom, but they are actively persecuted. There's a prejudice against them, and you have this balance of sympathy in favor of the Muslim population. And that feeds into something larger, which maybe we can talk about, which is the, particularly in the U.S. under Obama, a kind of pro-Islamism that characterized government policy. There's been no outrage about the persecution and genocide of Christians on the part of the Obama administration. Far from it. It took Congress to actually put pressure on John Kerry and pass a law condemning the genocide of Assyrian Christians for Kerry finally to be dragged sort of kicking and screaming into making a statement accepting the fact that there was a genocide. So that whole constellation is something that this anti-Christian mindset in the Western world is something that really needs attention. It may strike you as paradoxical that a Jewish organization, Canadian Institute for Jewish Research, is playing a role in trying to make this known and to offset it, but we feel a great deal of sympathy for our Christian brothers and sisters in the Middle East. We have experienced the same thing. People don't realize, but over 800,000 Jews were brutally expelled from the Middle Eastern countries just before and during and after the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948. So we've been through this, and the Jews, it turns out, are advantaged in a way because they founded their state through Zionism. They founded a democratic Jewish state in the Middle East, which is a haven and a protection. But Christians lack this. Christians lack this state protection because the Christian states, the traditionally Christian states, are not playing that role at all, far from it. And someone like Sargis, who you're going to hear from in a minute, one of his goals is to create a Syrian state adequate to defend Christians in the in Iraq and to some extent elsewhere. And it's a noble goal, and it needs to be supported.
And Dr. Crane, so you're saying, and just to reflect what you're saying, we can look at the immigration numbers, and you just gave some statistics as Christians in the Middle East. When you look at the Obama immigration numbers, you just see, the pro-Muslim narrative that you just talked about coming over with these immigration numbers, where you have, 10, 15,000 refugees being placed in the U.S. and 0.05% of those are Christian. And when you talked about, a 10% population in the Middle East, there's something wrong there. And again, why are the Western countries not being given the proper information about this? One, and two, not taking action when they, we hear, our last statistic we heard is that 70% of people in the U.S. polled say they're Christian. Why the inaction?
Why the silence? Right. Absolutely.
Yes, I mean, it's a major problem. It strikes one very much like the Holocaust. If you look around the world in the 1930s, as the Nazis rose to power and then expanded in Europe, there was a similar silence and a similar lack of concern. And that's part of why the Canadian Institute for Jewish Research is trying to do everything it can to make this known. I mean, we've been through that. And we can't stand silently by and watch it happen again. It sounds radical, but from everything I know and have read, we really are looking at the possible elimination of Christian groups of all kinds from the Middle East. And the problem isn't only in Iraq, and in Syria. I mean, if you look at look around the Middle East, and you look at Pakistan, you look at Lebanon, you look at the Palestinian Authority, Libya, Iran, Yemen, and one can go on, Nigeria in Africa with the Boko Haram groups, Indonesia, Sudan, the persecution of Christians in the South Sudan, Sub-Saharan Africa. Everywhere you look, Christians are being persecuted by Islamic countries. It's a terrible situation. And again, where is the UN on this? We hear nothing. Why aren't these murderers and genocidaires, as they're called, brought to the criminal court, the International Criminal Court? Why aren't there motions against them in the Human Rights Council of the United Nations? It's a scandal. It's a terrible thing that's going on, and We have to become aware of it, and we have to begin to do something about it.
If I can jump in here, and if you want to add to that, and take a look at the fact that the systems that we have, whether it be Department of State, Department of Defense, Congress, and Congress is the only element, I've always said, it can make something legal or illegal. All of them are so bogged down in their own politics that regardless of who is the president of the United States, they continue to allow this to happen. The Syrian numbers have been reduced since 2003 by 90%. Those numbers have been reduced. Initially, it was under the Kurdish regional government, supposedly protection, who literally picked up weapons out of the town of Kirkuk, left, turned over those areas to the ISIS as they abandoned the Christian Assyrians on the battlefield, who they were supposed to protect. Same thing with the Shia government of Iraq. The GOI loaded up on two C-130s, flew out of Mosul, again, abandoned those individuals. Same thing with the Sunni leadership that was initially given that area to be under their control, who literally left for their benefit. But they didn't escape back to Baghdad. They didn't escape to Erbil. They actually went to Syria. So the same leadership has now been brought back. So they escaped into the enemy lines. And they're back, and now we're trying to replace the Christian Assyrians again with the same individuals. Why? Because somebody has said that our formality sales and how we do business with the Department of State is much more important than a 7,000-year-old culture. And frankly, being a person who's been in the system, I know that that's not true, because I know how they get money to individuals in Syria. And the way they get that money is through other channels. But they will not do that for the Christian Assyrians who are going through a genocide. They will use every excuse beyond a regulation as to why they cannot do it. And I think it's a shame that in Syria, which is a country itself, they'll go ahead and have a change in the rules, but they will not try to have that change in the rules for Assyrian Christians in Iraq. We have currently 6,000 Assyrian capable men who are fighting under various different forces. They have come out with a joint statement, and all the churches came out with the joint statement while I was there in Iraq in October, the Chaldean, Syriac, and Assyrian churches, saying that we are behind this joint effort. They have said multiple times we're willing to work with the Yazidis to jointly protect our areas. But what do? We allow the Kurdish regional government to come in, pound all their villages into nothing. We allow the Iraqi government to come in, pound their villages into absolutely nothing. There's no infrastructure. Then we bring their forces in, and we establish those forces as security perimeters in that area. We fund them, allow them to use our taxpayer money to bring what they call their displaced people back, but yet the Christian Assyrians are left to basically try to sell trinkets on the sidewalks in Erbil. Where I was, that's basically how they were living. This is just an absolute mess created by these institutions who literally are following someone's mandate for that region, and I don't know if those institutions are going to change how they operate, even under the current president coming in.
Yeah, one of the really striking things here is the culpability of major Christian churches in the ongoing persecution of Middle Eastern Christians. If you look at outfits like the United Church of Christ, or the World Council of Churches, or the Episcopalians, Congregationalists, many of the Lutheran churches, the Methodists, these are Christian organizations which are not defending their own people in the Middle East. Far from it. What they're busy doing is attacking Israel and becoming centers for broadcasting what is called the new anti-Semitism. And it's really reprehensible. The papacy itself, where is the papacy? Where is Pope Francis in relation to the persecution of Middle Eastern Christians, including Greek Catholic Christians.
If I can add to that, Professor Krantz, as an example, when I was in Iraq, I was staying in a hotel in Erbil for a short period, for a couple of days, and there was a gentleman there who was a Baptist preacher, because I saw him trying to convert two Kurdish men, Kurdish Sunni men, to become followers of what he believes is, from the Baptist perspective, Jesus. Now, in those 2 days that he spent time trying to convert them, he never bothered to step outside the hotel during the nighttime and see that his Christian brethren were basically trying to survive on the streets. He was so focused on what he thought was a mission for his church, a mission that he had to convert these two Sunni men to become Baptists. He was just blinded about the fact that he needs to support others. Now, when I spoke to those Kurdish men when he wasn't present, the reality, as what struck me, was that they really wanted to find a way to get to the States. And for them, they honestly thought that that was a way for them to be able to come to the United States. So you got this Baptist preacher who's preaching to these two men who thinks that they're really more interested about conversion, who's not paying attention to what's happening to all these Assyrian Christian displaced Christians are outside the hotel, and those two men were more interested in using it as a platform to try to come to the United States than understanding that they're going to change your religious perspective at age of 34 and 42. So what happens is the churches get so bogged down in taking care of themselves and their institutions that they don't understand that they need to unite collectively to help each other. As an example, I've said it before, the Catholic Church opened up a university in Erbil, which is under the Kurdish regional government. Well, they didn't open up that university in order to convert Kurdish men, Sunni men, to become Catholics. They converted it. They established it there in order to be able to solidify their footprint in what they think is where their church is being destroyed. The Christian churches have united if the outside Western churches understand, and the fact that they recently came to the table and said, we have a joint force. We want our joint force supported. We're not military personnel, as far as the Patriarch of the Church of the East is concerned, or the Syriac Bishop in Iraq, or the Chaldean Patriarch, but we will join behind this so-called joint force to hopefully we can get to a point where it becomes a united force in order to allow these displaced people come back, govern their areas in the Syrian Inland Plain, which is their historical homeland. But yet, who's funding them? United States? Where is the funding going to come from? Who's going to finally say it's time to at least support this joint force effort?
Right, right. You know, it's I would hasten to add, I'm not condemning, you know, far from it, all Christians or Christianity in general. There are wonderful Christian groups which are working very hard to deal with this situation and to do something about it. You think of something like the International Christian Embassy in Jerusalem, the ICEJ, which has 80 chapters all over the world, in the U.S. and Canada, which does remarkable work. There is the American Christian Leaders for Israel group, ACCI, which does great work. And then Reverend Hagee's outfit called KUFI, Christians United for Israel. Christian evangelical movement, much of it, is conscious of what's going on. And where you find that Christians are pro-Israel, you find also that they are clearly pro-defense of Christian rights in the Middle East and elsewhere. But we're facing a very real and deeply rooted problem, because much of the problem is, part of what's going on is called de-Christianization. It's been going on since the Enlightenment, the 18th century. Increasingly secular values replacing religious values. And in fact, in much of the liberal world today, Christianity is a problem. And there are attacks on Christianity, attacks on faith-based movement and people. And it's in that context, I think, that that conscious Jewish people and Christian people have an identity of interest and really have to valorize one another, recognize each other, and work together. We're talking about Western civilization. And Western civilization is a product of the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's where it comes from. Sargis knows this very well. He knows his Tanakh. He knows the Hebrew Bible and the role of prophecy and the role of the notion of speaking truth to power and the idea of all men are brothers. It cuts a Judaic idea which is picked up by early Christianity. So we have an identity of interest. And one of the striking things, I think, about the modern world is that the only place in the modern world, and certainly in the Middle East, and it may even be in the West, where Christianity, where the Christian population is growing, is the Jewish state of Israel. I mean, it's a striking phenomenon. It's almost as if biblical prophecy about the role of the Jews in the coming of world peace is taking on flesh in our own time. It's quite striking.
This, as far as I'm concerned, I cannot think of a more important geopolitical topic to be talking about than this. And it's amazing to me that, and I do not take this the wrong way, but it's amazing that silence from the Western churches, yet you, a member of, well, the head of the Canadian Institute for Jewish Research in Canada, you're speaking out and doing what the Western churches have not done. And that's, you know, sounding the warning bells. What about some, just, I mean, there's got to be numbers here that people have to, when they hear, they should be shaking in their boots. And I know you've probably got some numbers. You had said some numbers earlier about the number of Christians being killed in the Middle East and Syria and, you know, Christianity, 10% of the population. We've got about 3 minutes left of this segment. So are there any...
Well, I maybe Sargis has some more stats. I would, with a few minutes remaining, I would simply say that there is a sense, I mean, to me, in which the recent American election is almost providential. I think the election of Trump and what he seems to represent, not him as a person, but the counter statements to contemporary radical liberalism and secularism that he embodies and the movement embodies are very hopeful for the future. I think the critique of political correctness, which is a mind-numbing kind of lack of critical intelligence, you know, and a sort of knee-jerk liberalism, to critique this, to reject it, to elect someone who is against it is a great step forward. I speak as a university professor, a teacher. Our campuses, there are many, many wonderful people on our campuses, but the campuses are also the locus of BDS, of the movement against Israel. That's a simple anti-Semitic movement. And it's popular on campus.
Doctor and Lieutenant Colonel, okay. Doctor, can we twist your arm for 10 more minutes of your time?
Or sure,
okay.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah. We're up against a break right now, 3 minute break. When we come back, we'll be rejoined with Dr. Krantz and Lieutenant Colonel Sangari on the Hagman and Hagman Report right after this.